Accession number 28678, Mr. Dermot Reeves, Rhodes, sorry, Real 13. All wrong there. Now, what happened next after Blythe? What was your next thing on the shanty as captain of the shanty?
Then we went down to the Mediterranean as guardship in Gibraltar.
Now, you said you remembered more about this visit. Well, obviously you would as captain. What do you remember of it?
I remember... well, as guardship, we had to do a certain amount of patrolling and making sure that the, we were letting the Spaniards know that we weren't going to be pushed around with regard to limiting our manoeuvrability and water space out there, and also to keep an eye on things generally.
And what were these patrols like?
Oh, they were fairly sort of basic low-key. We'd just go out into the Bay of Gibraltar and potter around just inside our territorial waters, keep an eye on Smoky Joe, who was still there, the elderly patrol vessel and frigates they had, the Spaniards had, and just maintain a presence, really.
The Smoky Joe and company, there were no military or naval match for your ship?
No.
In any way?
No. No.
Anything happened while you were doing this guardship business?
We used to go across the straits for two reasons. We had a training class of training officers, navigational classes, who came out, and we were taking them to sea, practicing running across the Straits of Gibraltar, which is very busy, letting them practice calling the captain and telling them what's going on, which was pretty stressful for me, I'll tell you. And that we were also keeping an eye out for smugglers, because then there were a lot of smugglers running in fast boats, drugs and cigarettes mainly then, from Morocco or Tangier.
So what were these anti-smuggling patrols like? How would you...
They were fairly basic. It was just occasionally you used to put up the helicopter looking for these things, or if we could catch them on radar, we might try and cut them off, but they were much faster than we were. But the main thing is we could then warn the shore authorities that there was something coming in, and they could be ready to meet them on the beach and nab them.
And did that actually happen?
Yes, it did once or twice, yeah. And you could see these craft. They were always sort of painted black or dark grey. You'd see them all tied up in the corner of the dockyard, worn out. They'd been arrested the night before, with huge engines on these very sharp and fast boats, only about 20 feet long.
Now, what happened? Anything else? Were you enjoying being a captain ashore at Gibraltar?
Well, it was wonderful. We had another great affiliation there with the Green Jackets, were the resident battalion out there. And so we had a lot of social exchanges and sporting exchanges with them at all levels.
And the Green what's their official name?
The Royal Green Jackets.
Right, they were just the...
Yeah.
And was that the whole ship's company?
Yeah, the whole ship's company. And their commanding officer was the Lieutenant Colonel Ramsbottom, David Ramsbottom, who... later became General Sir David Ramsbottom, Adjutant General of the Army, and later Inspector General of Prisons, in which he was a thorn in the government's side most of the time. And you still hear him being brought up by the BBC in Today programme as an expert on prisons. He was out there with the Green Jackets. Great. So that was great. We had a sort of... we never got on quite as well with the RAF there. It was the Army
Why
and the
not?
Navy. Well, the Army and Navy all seem to stuck together. I think we tend to look down for no particular reason on the RAF as being the young upstart service. And although we tend to do a lot of work with the RAF, probably much more with them than we do with the Army. Somehow we have the Army have great traditions, the Navy have traditions as well, and we just seem to get on well together.
Anything else about Gibraltar? I don't know how long you were there.
We were there for about, I think, 6 weeks or so, or more, doing guardship. No, worked hard and played hard yet again there.
Then what?
Then we came back. We had whilst we were in actually this was whilst we were in gym, yes. The marine engineer also came to me one day and said he thought he'd got a slight problem on the main shaft. Now, bearing in mind that we only had one shaft, one propeller, it was pretty serious. But he wasn't quite sure, and he wanted to take some time to unbutton various things to have a look at it. And he did, but it took several hours to do this, and he came back with his face. I had one look at his face, and I thought, this is a big problem. And he found that the main shaft was subject to major and very serious erosion or corrosion or something inside one of the main thrust blocks, the blocks which are there to support the shaft while it's rotating inside. And we'd lost about, it was quite considerable, about a third of the shaft, a cross-section of the shaft in this erosion. Now, the end result of this would have been, if we'd gone on without noticing this and gone on belting out at high speed, is that the propeller shaft would have been broken inboard, and that would have been a major, with a capital M, problem. Not only would it have stopped dead in the water, we would have had major fires and goodness knows what. I don't know what else, but we then had to fly out a team from UK, a specialist team, to come and look at this lot. And they hummed and hawed and hoo-hawed, and we, you know, the problem was there we were in Gibraltar. Were they going to try and repair it or do something about it there, or were they going to take us home? And so they eventually decided that we could come home at slow speed. So we did, 4 knots. Which took an age, you can imagine, a week. And all that while, we were wondering if the propeller shaft was going to last. The reason why we came at very slow speed, of course, if it did go, then it wouldn't be nearly so catastrophic in the damage area.
And where was this? Where were you refitted? We need a refit or repairs anyway.
Yeah, we came and we were repaired in Portsmouth, and they sorted it out. And then We had a couple of very nasty days, because we then went to we were going on a Meet the Navy visit to Newport in Wales. Now, we were going. The mayor of Cardiff at the time was a guy who'd been a National Service subaltern with me in the Mediterranean, and he was then an R&R commander. He was mayor of Cardiff. And he got tickets. It was the England-Wales International the day we arrived, and he got tickets for me to go and join him in the Mayor War of Books. And early in the morning, before we got to Newport, it was foggy. We were approaching up the mouth of the, we were going up the sort of Seven Estuary, and we got a major engine room fire. And this was very serious. Somehow the lube oil in the engine room had escaped through either a fault in the metal or something and sprayed out hot oil all over the engine room, and it just went up in smoke. The net result of this was that we were disabled, and we lay around there in the fog trying to sort out. We had to go to emergency stations trying to put the fire out. We actually lost 3 stokers, were killed in the engine room on that. And it was pretty traumatic. And we put the fire out through an extreme measure. On ships like that, in main machinery spaces, there are one of the most effective ways of putting out fires is to stop the supply of oxygen in the air. And one way to do that is to smother it. and the quickest and most effective way is by venting steam out of the main engine into the space there. It's called steam drenching. And we had to do that to actually get the fire out. But you imagine anybody in there would be killed instantly. And for me, having given the engineer officer permission to steam drench, because the fires were, we were not having any success under other methods of putting it out. The ammunition magazine bulkheads were warming up, heating up dangerously hot, so we had danger of ammunition exploding in the magazines down next to the main machinery space. It's the machinery room. And so it was a question of saving the ship and the lives of the men, and steam drenching. I did not know that there were three guys still in there. I had had a report earlier saying that everybody had been accounted for. And so we went ahead and steam drenched. When the fire was put out, we got back in down. We found the three guys in there. We were dead then, of course.
Had they been killed by the steam drenching or previously?
Well, as a result of post-mortem later, much to my relief, they'd actually been killed by smoke inhalation, not by the steam drenching. But I was asked at the time, I remember the Court of Inquiry, whether I would have done the same thing had I known there were still people down there. And I said, yes, it was a question of over 200 lives. If I'd known there were people down there, I would still have to do this rather than have a ship go up.
Now, what had caused the fire?
So it was this hot oil that had escaped through a faulty pipe or joint.
Something as simple as that.
There. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yes. But, you know, it had filled this big machinery's main engine room space and then got to the stage itself where it was ignited. And that went straight up.
No, you said there were two bad dudes you had. What was the second?
Oh, no, this was the second. I didn't want any more after this. And we were...
So the first bad dude was the propeller shaft.
Yeah, the propeller shaft. No, this was the second. And I went... We asked for help, and the frigate Penelope came out and stood by us. There was no question of us going into Newport. And... we had to get back. We'd still got these guys down there, and we needed to get back to a naval base.
And did Penelope help?
Oh, Penelope was there. No, she didn't do anything. She just stood there ready to help if required, with more men, equipment, firefighting, what have you. But we'd actually got the fire out by the time she arrived. But it was great to have her. So I asked for a tug, actually, to come and tow me to Portsmouth. And fleet staff said, yeah, okay. And so they sent a big ocean-going tug out, and we were towed to Portsmouth.
The second time you've been towed in, or well.
Well, no, we hadn't been towed in before.
Four knots.
We hadn't been to four knots. Yeah, and that you can imagine that journey back wasn't good. I stayed on the bridge the whole time because we were being towed around especially through that part of the sea. And then we were brought in Portsmouth. The three guys were, by which time they'd been parceled up in the hammocks and things, body bags, and they were taken off by helicopter and flown to Haslett before Naval Hospital, before we actually entered Portsmouth.
And that's where the post-mortem was done.
And I was met by a whole host of, you can imagine, the senior officers, and press and television. And the first thing I had to do was give a press conference. Well, I'd loved a briefing the captain of the fleet and one of the senior officers, and give a press conference and a television interview before we sorted ourselves out.
And were people sympathetic to you?
Oh, very sympathetic. Except the press were a bit... They got old, especially the local paper, got hold of the fact that when the ship first commissioned, and I didn't know this until they told me, but some years about 6 or 7 years, they'd lost a man overboard in bad weather out in the Bay of Biscay, something, and they said, oh, are you a jinxed ship? You know, its morale must be very low. I said, no, it's not. I said, it's like losing somebody of the family. And the ship's company are not demoralised, they're subdued, yeah, but they're certainly not demoralised. They fought hard to keep the ship afloat. And I was very proud of them. And so, anyway, that was all right.
Were the funerals a big thing?
Yes, yeah. The next of kin, which were, I think, two wives and parents, could either have their relatives buried in the naval cemetery at Tesla with full naval, you know, big naval funeral, or have a service at home. And two of them decided to have them in the naval cemetery at Hesla, and we went through a full thing then with them, which was very moving. And I met the parents and the wives.
They didn't blame
you. Whom I already wrote to. No, it was very humbling. I mean, my parents kept thanking me so much for all I'd done for them. I thought, good heavens. And I just found it very humbling that they should take that attitude. There was not one word of recrimination. I had to answer some pretty pointed questions in the Board of Inquiry, mind you.
Now, tell me about the Board of Inquiry.
Well, I'm not allowed to say any more about that.
That's fine. So okay, so what happened after this incident? I mean, I presume, was there, again, a necessity for quite a big repair?
Well, as it happened, the ship was just about due a refit then, so they decided to refit the ship. I mean, the problem of the propeller shaft still hadn't been 100% solved, and they also, with the fire in the main machinery space, and there was nowhere that the ship was going for some time after that, so they decided to refit, and we did that in Portsmouth.
And you stayed with her during this period?
I stayed, well, I did and I didn't, and then that's the next chapter in my history. The answer is yes, I did stay with her, because I took her out at the end of the refit, and so did the ship's company. But in the meantime, something else happened, which was a milestone in my career.
Now, what was that?
Well, this was in 1976, I think. The Cod War was raging, and our frigates were taking a bit of a battering up there from these Icelandic gunboats, because frigates are built for high-speed dashes around the fleet, and they're fairly flimsy. They've got no armour plating, anything like that. And these little gunboats by the Icelandic have been specially designed for a sort of ice breaking and being fairly robust. And they were having physical tussles with our frigates up there. The gunboats were trying to cut the trawls of our fishing boats, because they reckon we were fishing inside their territorial waters. We weren't, actually, because they'd unilaterally extended their waters. And so our ships were getting a bit battered. And so it was decided to take two frigates out of reserve, specially reinforce them for Icelandic patrol work during the Cod War. And the two frigates were selected. There was one, the HMS Llandaff in Plymouth, and HMS Jaguar in Chatham. And I got a phone call one day from the naval appointer saying, pack your bags, alert, and get to Chatham and take the Jaguar out on anti-Cod War duties. Now, and I did that. And at the same time, roughly, a whole host of other people, a whole ship's company, were getting phone calls, officers from in various places, and sailors from bits here, there, and everywhere, to go to Chatham and take the Jaguar. Now, HMS Jaguar, which is sadly the only Jaguar I've ever owned or driven, was an anti-aircraft frigate, a diesel engine frigate. Great ship. Main arm was two twin 4.5-inch guns. with also 40mm anti-aircraft guns.
No, she was a frigate.
She was a frigate. She was about 2,000 tons. But diesel-powered.
Now, how had she been strengthened?
Well, the dockyard had strengthened her by, first of all, wrapping round the bow a half-inch thick armoured plate right round the bow from top to right below the waterline to the deck line. And this plate extended about 20 feet aft either side. They strengthened the forepeak internally. They built extra strengthening rods into it, welded them in there. And they also filled and compartmentalized a lot of the bow section, even more than it was, and filled it with five-gallon cans full of ping-pong balls for buoyancy. So if it was hulled, that would remain buoyant. And it did carry out a similar sort of exercise around the stern and wrapped half-inch armour plate around the stern and put extra buoyancy in the stern as well.
Now, did all this work?
Well, we never found out. We got this Motley Ships Company from, I think the first lieutenant was a lovely guy called Robin Bawtry, who was the Navy squash champion, from HMS Dryad, where he was an instructor. The supply officer, another first class man, was from Collingwood, where he was a captain. So he'd only just been promoted sub-lieutenant.
So all of you were makeshift crew?
Absolutely makeshift.
You all had your own commissions?
We all had our other jobs, a lot on the shore. And so we got... There was this strange ship. Nobody had, I'd never driven a frigate, diesel frigate before. It was powered by eight marine versions of a bus engine. Four on each shaft. And the propellers, it was not like... It was variable pitch propellers. So you control the speed by varying the pitch of the propeller. Very quick reacting. Wasn't terribly fast, about 24 knots, but that was enough for the job. But very long legs, could go for ages, days and days and weeks without refueling.
How old was she?
Not that old. I mean, she was no more than about 15 years old, I suppose. Fairly modern post-war frigate, as they went. They did a whole series of air direction and... anti-aircraft frigates, the Lynx, Jaguar, Leopard, Puma, and then the Cathedral class, similar in every ship except for equipment, and that was the Lander and other Cathedrals, Chichester, so on and so forth.
Now what happened when you joined her at Chatham?
And I got together this crew and we hastily cobbled together a quick program for work up at Portland, or well, get the ship to sea, do some quick trials, work up at Portland, and then go off to Iceland.
Now, how did this program go?
And that worked very well. We did our basic ship safety work up at Portland, and then a series of... we didn't do so much anti-aircraft work and other type work, but we did a series of exercises trying to ride off these gunboats when they were coming into... to cut the
now,
or ride
how
over
these
the
exercises
trawlers.
Go? I mean,
extremely well. I thought we did very well indeed, for two reasons. The boats we were trying to ride off on the workup exercises were the big patrol craft in Portland. Now, because they'd welded this great steel thick plate around the bows of the ship, okay, so we lost a knot or two in speed. But what it did do is throw up a huge bow wave. And so it looked as if we were actually going about twice as fast as we actually were. And so it was a bit intimidating to see this great grey thing coming, belting down on you with this huge bow wave. With the twin screw and these variable pitch propellers, it was extremely manoeuvrable. Would stop very quickly, accelerate very quickly, and turn very quickly. And I found, certainly with the patrol craft there, I could turn inside them, I could accelerate quicker, and I could stop, decelerate much more quickly. And so I had really not much problem in riding off these Portland patrol boats who were trying to act like Icelandic gunboats.
Now, so how long did this process take?
Well, this workup lasted, it was very much reduced, down to a couple of weeks. And we did lots of it, advanced navigation and things like that, because strange things happen to compasses and navigational aids up in the Arctic. And
it's all based off the Portland. Poles.
This was all based off Portland, yeah.
So what then?
Well, as we finished our workup, almost on the to the day, and we were all raring to go and sort out these guys up in Iceland, the government announced a solution to the Cod War. So, I mean, they come to some agreement with the Icelandics, and there was no more barging about and bashing of ships together. And so there we were with this crew absolutely raring to go, straining at the leash to go to sea, with this frigate all ready to go. And our main task suddenly taken away. However, they then said, right, well, we're going to run you for 6 months because there are a number of frigates in the fleet who've been battered in Iceland getting repaired. We'll run you as a fleet frigate. And so we joined the fleet program, and funnily enough, the first thing we did was go and do a distant water fishery protection patrol up in the Arctic.
So you were fleet frigate with the home fleet?
With the home fleet.
Can you, before we'll come up with the other thing next time, but what is the role of a fleet frigate?
Well, a frigate that was attached to the home fleet was part of the home fleet, and would be one of two or three squadrons of frigates who were available to the Commander in Chief home fleet. Now, the frigates had a multi-purpose role. They could act as escorts to the heavies, the carriers, and the big ships. They could act as, they could act as maritime warfare units in their own right. They had the capability of anti-submarine, anti-air, and naval gunfire support, in other words, supporting the army ashore with their main armament. They had a role in anti-terrorism, anti-smuggling, disaster relief, fairly versatile. And so you were used for whatever purpose Commander-in-Chief thought fit, or fleet headquarters, either attached to other units for a big operation or operating on your own.